Welcome to Stars Matter, a recruiting podcast from The Athletic. I'm Mitch Light, joined by Ari Wasserman. And this week, Ari, we have our first two-time guest to Stars Matter, Andy Staples. And I can tell by that reaction right there, Andy, you did not know that you were the first two-time guest. Are you honored?
I am honored. Wow, a repeat
guest.
Well,
his name is on the feed.
Well, the money in Vegas had Max Olson, probably. If you're doing a recruiting podcast and you're looking at athletic employees, Max Olson would probably be the favorite to be the first two-time guest.
He is the portal authority.
Yes, but Andy, it's you.
Now, I did make Max do a podcast with me on Tuesday night after Bob Bowlsby resigned. So Max is probably, you know, about podcasted out this
week. So that's why he didn't respond to me when I was editing that story last night. So
there you go.
All right, today we'll look at some notable commitments from the class of 2023, including a recent five-star. Plus, we're going to look at what positions are coming off the board the quickest in the 2023 class. It's sort of a trivia question. It's not the official trivia question, so Ari, keep that in mind. We've got one more final star from the class of 2022 who's about to commit. We'll talk about David Ubben's story that published today, A Nightmare In-Home Visits. Ari, I hope you did your homework and read that story. If not, you'll have to fake it, like what you probably did in school a lot, pretending to read something. And then
I got a 3.0.
Okay, we'll dip into we'll see what grade you get for this.
3.0.
Yeah, we'll see what.
Well, I mean, it's pretty good for zero effort.
Yeah,
I suppose.
And we'll dip into the mailbag, and we will have the official trivia question. But I guess there's two notable things that happened in recruiting. One for the 2022 class, Lebius Overton, a defensive tackle from Georgia who reclassified to 2022. Committed to Texas A&M, adding to already a record-breaking class. And then on Friday night, Josh Connerly Jr., the last remaining five-star from 2022 from the Seattle area, is committing. And by all accounts, it's going to be USC. So, Ari, first of all,
it's not going to be Washington, I'll tell you that
much. It's not going to be Washington. First, let's get to Overton. You know, you wrote about it in This Week in Recruiting. Just that's all they needed. Not only do they need another five-star, let's give them another defensive lineman.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a record-breaking class because you made me look that up, and this is the first time in the history of modern-day recruiting that a team has signed 8 five-star prospects, which is pretty insane. But on top of that, and I guess it kind of goes hand-in-hand, but they've also signed 8 of the top 25 players in the country, which is like a third of the most elite players. And Andy, you might jump in on this, but because Florida's 2010 class was nasty, but this is on paper the best class of all time. I mean, like eight of the top 25. I don't even know if you could ever even do better than that.
Like, there's got to be a ceiling too. I mean, Andy, speak to that. Like, I mean, in an era
Florida's was like that because it had Ronald Powell and Dominique Easley and Sharif Floyd. Now, if Powell had not had knee issues and had lived up. So I believe Powell is he still the highest rated recruit of all time?
He's one of four with perfect score, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, if he had lived up to that hype, because Easley and Floyd were both first rounders. I think Matt Elam was in that class as well and was a first rounder. So maybe, but I mean, in terms of depth on the D line, I don't think I've ever seen a class like this. And I'm not used to many schools signing this many defensive linemen, period. A lot of times, you know, you're just not going to take that many. But if people at this level that and I realize, look, the rankings are what they are, but all you have to do is look at the schools that wanted these guys. These are takes for pretty much every school. If they want to come together, let them. I mean, there's not enough snaps to go around, but you let that sort itself out.
I don't care how good you are. You cannot say no to a five-star defensive lineman. Ari, you mentioned this in This Week, and we've talked about this on the podcast. Alabama, the state of Alabama's elite 2023 class, and how many guys will end up at Alabama. But that's also position heavy. I think three of the five stars in Alabama this year are cornerbacks. Now, I don't have know Alabama's roster off the top of my head. I'm sure they could find room for all three if they want to get there, but it's also very defensive line heavy.
They can find room for all three on the field at the same time if they want to. They only recruit corners for the secondary anymore.
There's no such thing as a core a player that's a five-star prospect who plays a position you don't have room for. You have a room for a five-star athlete no matter what. I don't care what your depth chart looks like.
Not recruiting a five, you know, they're not recruiting.
There's
quarterback.
If Ohio State is in recruiting a five-star player, oh yeah, you don't think if Arch Manning called up and said, "Hey, I'd like to come up to Columbus," they'd find room for him?
I guess so.
There isn't a single position player at any roster that you don't take, no matter what. Especially now when players are leaving just as quickly as they're coming in. But the thing that I wanted to say about A&M more so than anything is that they got player. I mean, 16 out of their 26 or 7, I don't remember what it was, commitments. We're from the state of Texas, so they did a great job of taking care of home. But they got two out of Florida, four out of Georgia, two out of Louisiana, two out of Washington, one out of Arizona, one out of Pennsylvania, and one out of Tennessee, who I think was the first or the number one player in the country. Yes. So, like, whatever they did last year, and I guess everybody's, like, going to scream NIL into their computer screens, and if that's what you think, then that's what you think. But that is high. Like, I couldn't say a single negative thing about what they did last year. And did you have a prompt that had nothing to do with A&M that I just went back to because I'm a huge Aggie homer?
No, we're talking about Overton. You know, that was fair.
Oh, yeah,
fair
yeah. Yeah.
But also, you can talk about Connerly, too. Or Connerly, I guess it is. We've talked enough about how it's a blow for him not to go to Washington. The fact that, you know, it looks like it's USC. They've got a small class. What is it, 12 commits? So this is a big get.
But I want to ask Andy this, and I'll ask you too, Mitch, but if there's any conference in the country where the most important player isn't quarterback, would you say that, and maybe it's always quarterback, but just for the sake of discussion, in the SEC, if you don't recruit defensive linemen, you've got no shot, right?
Correct.
So, like, is this like, I mean, to me, this is, it seems like an abundance at one position, and I guess that if you sign a bunch of players and they're all in the same position, then it might have a hard time having that impact, because if they're not on the field, they're not impacting the game. But at defensive line, I think that is completely not true.
Well, it's not the same position. Like, going back to the A&M class, Walter Nolan and Shamar Stewart don't play the same position.
Right.
They're different people. They play different roles on the defensive line. And offensive line's the same way. I think they're equally important. And, you know, if you recruit well in a line of scrimmage, you can cover up almost everything else. The quarterback is still going to be the most important, but I think what Georgia showed us last year is that if you have dudes on both sides of the line of scrimmage, you can play with anybody.
And what this does, it just, whatever the hit rate is on five stars, let's say it's 60%, 70%, it just increases their chances of having four or five absolute studs on the field at the same time.
Right. And I mean, that's the thing with A&M, like, yeah, some of these guys are going to transfer. It's okay. It's not a big deal. Like,
how many do they have to hit on? If they have 16 top 100 players, how many do they have to hit on to be an elite team in 2 years?
Even a 50% hit rate
is what I would say.
It gives you eight,
which is
top
low.
100 players that hit.
How
many other classes have had that?
Because that's what people don't remember. Like, oh, half of them are going to transfer. Who cares? If eight of them hit,
right?
They literally,
some of the ones that don't hit are still going to be good players. Like, let's say you have four absolute busts who can't play in the SEC. Those other four are still going to be good players that could be solid backups. So,
yeah. I mean, what do we constitute as a hit? Is a hit like
all conference,
really good all conference player, or just a starter?
I think a starter, multiple year starter who gets drafted.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, drafted probably in the first four rounds.
So
I would go as far as say drafted.
Yeah, all conference doesn't really always tell the story, because there can be politics involved. It can be a guy who blows up in his last year. But if the NFL says he's a top four round draft pick, he's pretty good. So
are you, Connerly to USC, obviously very important for the Pac-12, I'd say, to
keep
him in the footprint.
Oh, yeah. Well, because he wasn't going to be staying at Washington. So the fact of the matter, and he hasn't announced his decision yet, so I guess we have to suspend some
thoughts. Right, some like thought. We know. Somebody
commented on my story that he could go to Oregon. I wouldn't hold your breath, but, you know, you never know, I guess. The thing about this isn't just because, like, I think Washington is a West Coast. Like, I don't know how much you want to emphasize the national success of that, because it's a West Coast team. You know, it's still a really, really far away place from Southern California. So, I mean, I guess to a certain extent, it's a national recruit. But the thing that I'm excited about for USC and my $1,000 bet with Andy that they'll make the playoff in 3 years is that their number one weakness as a program has been line play. So if Lincoln Riley is going to open up the program into going and getting five-star offensive tackles that live a 2.5-hour flight away from where you are, you do that. And it's just like we all know in this podcast and anybody listening that Clay Helton's not going to get in that guy, you know, and we're talking about a recruit too that had really been leaning towards Michigan for a long time, took official visits to multiple places.
And right, maybe Chris part of the recruited from Oregon.
I mean, and we're talking about somebody who seemed to delay his decision because when he was, you know, considering Michigan, Jim Harbaugh, you know, NFL rumors were flying high, and then Lincoln Riley comes in and turns the heat on, and you know, next thing you know, we're in April and he's about to make a decision. So if he picks USC, which is what we're all anticipating, that's the exact type of thing that you want to see out of USC if all the hype that I'm pumping into that program is true. And it's not just California and skill position players. This is if they're going to ever make the playoff or win a playoff game, we all know that they're going to have to do more than just recruit Southern California. So this is a really good sign at a position of great need in a state that's far away. I think it's a home run. I think you can make the case that outside of Malachi Nelson, this would be the most important commit that they've gotten in either class.
Or you know, they've recruited highly rated linemen throughout the years. They just haven't done anything with them.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, there's like, I think that the appeal when you think about Lincoln Riley at USC is like, oh, what cool five-star quarterback from Atlanta is USC going to be in the mix for next year or whatever. And it's just like, I don't think people necessarily view Lincoln Riley, and of course he's had great offenses, but it, synonymously with high-end offensive line plays. So attracting that, I think, is
well, I think people, I'm not saying people surprising. View Bill Beedenbow with high-end offensive
line. I'm not saying
play,
it's surprising.
He stayed
I'm saying
he didn't come with Riley.
Yeah. I just think it's a very, very good early return on that investment.
Big investment, well, big return.
Well, we'll see. I mean, again, give me a whole class full of them, then we'll talk. Because, again, they have been recruiting good offensive linemen or highly touted offensive linemen.
Sign a class that has 9 people in it if he joins, and half of them are in the top 100, and the only half that aren't are – or all of them came after
right.
he got hired.
So it sounds like Pete Carroll classes, which is what you got to do.
That's all you know what I care about.
Yeah, it's what you got to do.
I want Pete Carroll classes.
All right, some other commitments from 2023. Penn State flipped a tight end from your favorite state, Ari, Massachusetts.
Can we talk about how funny that is? Can you do it so people don't get mad at me? You know what I'm exactly what I'm thinking, right?
About the Massachusetts pipeline that it
yeah and the fact that Don Brown is now the head coach at Massachusetts and
so Penn State this is a recruiting flips, coup? Not only did they get him away from Don Brown end. They got him away from Michigan
it's so funny how much they invested in Michigan fans were defending their Massachusetts pipeline when it didn't make any sense. And I know a few guys hit. Okay. I'm not saying it's a complete.
And this is the year to have one, though.
This is like the best Massachusetts class in the history of recruiting. And don't they have like a really good quarterback who's committed somewhere? Nebraska. Yeah, Nebraska.
He's a 3-star, top 500 player.
Okay.
But it's Massachusetts, though. This is a record
haul. There's 5-star offensive lineman that Ohio State's after. This is a good year for Massachusetts. So it's Andrew Raplia from Milton, Mass. Had been committed to Michigan for only about a month or so. Committed to Penn State, number 373 overall and number 19. NC State with a big commitment in-state. Got him away from your friend Mac Brown, Ari. Javonte Vereen, 4-star, another tight end in-state. Top 350 kid. Mississippi State got a 4-star offensive lineman from Laurel, Mississippi named Malik Ellis. And not a 4-star here, but I put him on here because he's top 400. Rutgers with a 3-star offensive lineman from Union City, New Jersey, Jasire Peterson. So I was looking at the class of 2023 guys that have come off the board. So question for both of you. I went by the top 25 players at each position in the class of 2023.
Research machine.
Which position do you think has the most guys off the board?
It doesn't feel like the quarterbacks have started to fall yet, so I'm going to go with the O-lineman.
My guess would be it isn't quarterback, because if it was, this wouldn't be a question.
Right. Quarterbacks is second, by the way.
It is? Okay, yes. I'm going to go receiver.
Shockingly, I don't know what the deal is. 16 of the 25 tight ends are off the board.
Oh.
Seems very random.
Limited supply?
I guess, but you can sign multiple times, you know. Yeah.
No, but
it's like a fantasy draft, though.
There are a limited number of people who fit the physical mold skill set that you're looking for. That's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah. Because two of these guys I just mentioned were tight ends, too.
Did Penn State prompt that research?
No, I was, because I have a spreadsheet of the quarterbacks off the board. It's 11 quarterbacks. And then when I was doing research, noticed the two tight ends. I was like, wow, that seems like a lot of tight ends off the board. So then I added. So I'll go tight end 16 of 25, quarterback 11 of 25, safety 8, offensive lineman 5, cornerback and wide receiver 4, linebacker and running back 3, and then defensive line only 2. So I don't know if this fits.
You know, it reminds you of a fantasy baseball draft. Nobody wants to draft a closer until the first one goes, and then when it happens, the dominoes start falling and everybody takes them. Maybe that's what happened at the tight end possession.
Yeah, we'll have to ask.
That's an interesting stat, though.
Yeah. All right, Andy, a couple of weeks ago, we had a good question from the mailbag. I forgot who it was, but we talked about it. If you were starting a Power 5 school from scratch,
mm-hmm.
where would you put it geographically?
Atlanta,
most advantageous recruiting spot.
In Atlanta, considering Georgia.
Okay, so you'd be willing to butt heads with Georgia and Georgia Tech?
Yes.
Okay.
I would not position it like Georgia Tech. Like, I would have majors that are easy. I would be very easy to get into. Like that's
what would the university be called, Andy?
The University of Georgia at Atlanta? UGA.
UGAT?
The University of Atlanta.
Yeah.
That's like, it's sort of like USF should be the University of Tampa, but there's been a private school called the University of Tampa there forever. So they couldn't call it that. So they called it University of South Florida, which is weird because it's not actually in South Florida. So
I was 32 when I found out that I wasn't in.
you're 32 right now, right?
I'm 34.
Oh, yeah.
My answer was San Diego. I figured you had your own city and you're close enough to Southern California that there's enough recruits.
I wouldn't put it on the West Coast. Because I can't get the fans fired up. Like,
yeah. Atlanta's interesting. You know, Ari said Philadelphia. That was.
Yeah, there's so many people in Atlanta, and there's so many good players.
The answer is probably Atlanta, Mitch.
And we're more so that's why we had Andy on the show.
Yeah.
Because, now that he's talking about it, I'm like, guys, I picked Philly over Atlanta.
And it took him 5 seconds Tech's to come
there.
Up with that.
Yeah. You're right, because there's a Power 5 school already there, and I think that's what scares people off.
I think when you originally prompted it, though, you said it doesn't have a Power 5 program in it already.
I don't remember that specifically, because I threw out there another program, even in L.A., because UCLA doesn't recruit like it should. So I don't think that was one of the parameters.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you could put one in Denver, but and that could be kind of a regional hub kind of Dallas? Place. But Boulder's not far from Denver, so
I guess Dallas maybe. But the Texas is so
there's a Power 5 school in Fort Worth. So yeah. I mean, TCU's yes, you could probably
is TCU private.
Yes,
I thought so. So you could be University of I know there is a University of Texas Dallas or whatever, but you could be the Texas and Texas
right and there is Dallas. A University of Dallas. The difference is I think University of Atlanta is available as a name.
we can copyright that name. All right, get
now,
on that.
What somebody's yelling at their
should
radio
just be Texas Dallas University
is
TDU.
Georgia State is already a state university in Georgia that is in Atlanta. Why don't you just make that into a Power 5 program? And conceivably you could.
What's the school Friday Night Lights? West where he almost took the job.
Oh,
it's like
God,
one of my favorite shows of all time. I can't. That wasn't Texas.
He didn't call it Texas Western because that's what UTEP used to be called.
West Texas something? No, it wasn't West because it was.
That's a great show. And by the way, and I don't know if we're allowed to talk about this, but I'm going to anyway.
We're allowed to talk about anything.
Lila Garrity, my number one of all time.
That's Minka Kelly.
You know where she went to college on the show, Ari?
Where did she go to college?
What do you think?
Michigan?
Vanderbilt.
Oh, she did.
Yeah,
so, that's right.
My friend Lee Jenkins tweeted that's is the greatest signee for Vanderbilt ever when Lila Garrity said she was going to Vanderbilt.
So you know that I played high school football against the actor who played Jason Street, right?
I think that rings a bell.
Yeah, Scott Porter played for Lake Howell, and we played.
Handsome man.
He was on varsity. He's a little bit young. I think he's a year or two younger than me. So the only time we would have both been on varsity at the same time was my senior year. And I asked him, I interviewed him once, and I said, what's the most Friday Night Lights finish of any game you ever played in? And he's like thinking back on it. And I'm like, I'll spoiler alert. You guys were heartbroken. Oh. And he's like, oh, the Lake Mary game. And I was like, yep, that's right. Cause it was the craziest game. Like it was pretty even all the way through, back and forth. They score to go up like 3 or 4 late in the game. We went 3 and out or something, punted to them. We figure it's over. Their running back takes off and is running down the field. He's trying to stay in bounds to keep the clock running. And we had this crazy safety named Donnie Casey, who actually was a member of USF's inaugural signing class in 1996. Donnie was one of those do everything guys. Like he played free safety. He was a tailback and he was nuts. And so he runs down this running back, and this is along our sideline. So we're all just standing there watching it. And he goes, "Give me that." And he rips the ball out of his hands. I don't know if Scott, because Scott was a receiver, so I don't know if he was on the field at the time on this play. But so Donnie just goes, "Give me that," rips the ball out of his hands, turns around and runs into the end zone like 40 yards away for a touchdown. The officials couldn't even like they had to huddle to figure out what had happened.
So it was the Maurice Claret play, but in high school.
Yeah. Yeah. So we won the game, but yeah, Scott Porter heartbroken on the other sideline, and then he got to be Jason Street, and then what was it? He was in a CBS show too. Oh, The Good Wife for one of those.
Was
like,
he? I don't know.
Dude has made some bank over his career. He's doing all right.
This is a recruiting show. And I wanted to ask you this, and I think you've touched on it a little bit. Like one program that you visited should have offered you a scholarship and didn't, and it made your mom mad. But do you have
Duke.
Any
I didn't visit them. They recruited me as a walk-on. Yeah.
Do you have any recruiting stories or anything that you remember from your recruitment, I guess?
I had my first beer on an official visit.
Yeah, tell us about that official visit. I've always wanted to ask you about this.
Do you want to know what the lawless renegade school is named that allowed me to be served beer on an official visit? You have the right conference.
Princeton.
It was Princeton. And so I get there and my host...
A letter in the mail, I think.
Sanctions.
What is the letter, called?
My host is this guy named Tom Stanley. He was a defensive end from like West Palm Beach. First words out of his mouth, "I signed us up for a bartending class. I have never had a drink in my life." And I'm like, all right, this is college. Here we go. So yeah, it was fun. And
I mean, when you think about keg ragers, you definitely think Princeton.
Ivy League kids can pound, Ari.
Yeah, they
I know. I've seen the social network.
Definitely knew what they were doing. They had just gotten their 95 Ivy League championship rings. All the players. And so like we'd walk up they don't call them fraternities and sororities. They're called eating clubs. And so they'd walk up to the door of the eating club and knock on the door. And just like the guys on the team was just hold out their fingers with the rings on them. And they just let them in.
It was great, beautiful town.
Like Tiger Inn, which was, I remember watching because Brooke Shields went to Princeton. I remember she had a TV show. Was it Suddenly Susan? Where she's wearing a Tiger Inn t-shirt. I'm like, oh, I had Milwaukee's best light in a keg in their basement one time. So, but yeah, that was it. The problem with that for me, the reason I didn't do it because, get a chance.
Yeah, I was going to ask you why
would have been awesome.
You go to an Ivy League school.
Yeah. So they stopped giving athletic scholarships in the Ivy League in the mid-90s. So a few years before there was a guy named David Sprinkle, who played for Lake Brantley, which was my high school's rival. He was they were a triple option team. He's a fullback. He was awesome. I went to school with his sister, Beth, in middle school. And David got a scholarship, like an athletic scholarship to Harvard, like full ride to freaking Harvard. And so, yes, if that had been an option for me, I would have absolutely taken it. But at the time, they just banned athletic scholarships in the Ivy League. And it was, you fill out the FAFSA, and whatever federal aid you qualify for, you get. And I was, my parents were high school teachers, so we weren't poor, but we certainly weren't rich. And at the time, if you were in the middle class, you were pretty squeezed. Like they weren't going to give you a ton of money. You were going to be taking out massive loans. And I knew I wanted to be a sports writer. So my thought was, I'm never going to make more than 40 grand a year. So why would I do this? Like, I don't want to be a senator. Wrong. I don't want to be a lawyer. And with the Ivy League schools, they'd all recruited me. And the guy who was recruiting me for Harvard was Lou Anarumo, the current defensive coordinator.
Wait, did you have like a really, really good GPA in high school? Like, were you like a super student?
Yes.
So that's why you were like rolling your eyes in my 3.0, because I was proud of my 3.0.
Yeah, I didn't put much effort forth for the 4.3 weighted or whatever.
But
I
also
had,
very, very solid students.
So he didn't. He also gave no.
Well,
gave
I also, no effort, I also had a really good SAT score.
So that is the formula for Ivy League recruiting right there.
I took my SAT without studying for it. My dad dropped me off there in the morning, and I was still hungover or and moderately drunk. I took.
I had not had a drink yet. I didn't have a drink until Princeton
because it was prom night. It was the morning after prom night, and I got an 11:50, and then my dad took me to Chompies to get pancakes
after. To prom my junior year, so that would have never worked. No, I took the we had a really good guidance counselor at my school who made sure everybody understood the importance of the PSAT, like if you want to get in the National Merit Program and all that. So we were very prepared for all that stuff. That's the people at my high school, at Lake Mary High School, and my parents, they were the ones who made sure I was prepared for all that. They did a fantastic job.
I feel bad because I cost my parents a lot of money by not.
Well, not putting in much effort. Here's where I kick myself though, because obviously everything worked out great. I got to walk on at Florida. I met my wife there. Got to work with some amazing people at the school paper that had helped, you know, make me better and help me prepare me to be in this job. But if I'd have gone to Princeton, I would have been on the same team as Ross Tucker and Kyle Brandt, and that would have been fun. That would have been a lot of fun.
You probably also would be living in that beach house that you want to live in. Down on the panhandle.
I still would have done it. That was the big joke is like I got to SI and there were a bunch of Princeton people in the upper management at SI. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, well, I would have ended up working at Sports Illustrated. Well, I did that anyway.
Yeah, I guess I would have gone to Princeton and just become an investment banker and live like Jordan Belfort, but I guess you were different. You know?
Well, I would have just hung on Kyle Brandt's coattails, like meet some real world friends, and when he got on Days of Our Lives, we're like, can I get a walk on in Days of Our Lives?
Wow, we have somebody who almost got a more prestigious education than Mitch on the show. Not almost, not better, but that's my goal.
So I actually was offered the Fred Russell Grantland Rice Sports Writing Scholarship at Vandy, but
that's what I intended on.
It only paid half, and half was a lot.
You know what? When I got it, it was full. They lost the fun. Yeah, I was headed to Tulane.
So did Grantland die? Did they stop funding his?
I'll tell you what,
Fred was still alive when I.
Yeah, so it was full scholarship. I was going to go to Tulane. My whole family's from New Orleans, but I applied to Vanderbilt because of the scholarship. And said I'll go there. If I was actually deciding between Tulane and Lehigh, two very very different schools, and then decided to go to Tulane. And at that point, they gave the scholarship winner at the Kentucky Derby because it was funded by the Thoroughbred, this guy named Charles Sella, who was part of the Thoroughbred Racing Association of America. So they had a little committee there. So I found out I was at work at the liquor store. I worked at a liquor store. Some guy named DK Smith from Vanderbilt, the most Southern voice I'd ever heard in my life.
I think DK was still on the job
So offered me the scholarship and I think they just this guy Charles Sella, they just didn't fund it as much. With the scholarship. I think a few years after my group, it was one a year, became a half scholarship. So like when I did it, you couldn't say no. Like wasn't gonna do say no and pay full freight to Tulane. So
well, and like, now after all that hard work and accomplishment, you're on a podcast with an idiot that went to U of A.
Man, an idiot that went to University of Florida.
We're all idiots.
UF wasn't that hard to get into when I got into it. And it was free for me. I mean, that was the deciding factor is they had the Florida Undergraduate Scholars Program, which I think is now called Bright Future. So if you had decent grades in high school, you basically got your tuition covered at a state university in the state of Florida.
I have one more question for Andy. No, I want him to finish.
What year were you? Because I can figure out who got the scholarship the year you
96.
Turned it down. Was that Tyler Kepner?
I don't know.
Well, so you were, 93 was my senior year. No, I think Kepner was... Tyler Kepner from the New York Times.
It wasn't Wolken. I know that. He's younger.
Yeah, he's much younger. Kepner, it was my friend Matt O'Keefe, whom I'm on a text thread with right here.
It wasn't Lee. So
no, Lee's younger too. So it wasn't Kepner. Yeah, so it was Matt O'Keefe. When we're done with this podcast, I'll send Matt a message, and he can thank you.
Well, no, there's a great list of people that I keep, and I it's funny because every few years I find another person to add to it, of people who turned down the University of Tennessee beat job at the Chattanooga Times Free Press. Before I got it, Like I've gotten it up to like 6 or 7 people at this point who turned it down before they offered it to me.
Are you like that coach who says I was my wife's 7th choice? You know, when he talks about
absolutely 100%. And I was using it in an ad read for a while, and it's, I'm not making it up. It's 100% true. Like the sports editor, when he called me, he said, we've offered it to several people, and then huge audible sigh. And now we're down to you.
All right. We do need to move on. All right.
But I want to say one thing before we go.
Then I got to say one more.
Because you guys are laughing at me about all your partial scholarships. But you know what I found out?
You're laughing at yourself.
I took the full one, Ari. They paid me to go to UF.
Mitch got a full one. I had to pay for my education. And I found out last week that it costs more money to send our 6-month-old baby to daycare for a year than my entire college education cost.
Well, she'll get a better education at daycare than you did, probably.
Jed Fish is not touching that one.
Yeah. Okay, so we got to move on. But did you guys think that I thought Tim Riggins was the prototypical college fullback? Like, he went offer from San Antonio State. I know he had baggage, but he should have got some high P5 offers. Maybe because he's an alcoholic.
No, Tim Riggins is a classic walk-on. Tim Riggins is a scholarship guy in a Power 5 program. That's a walk-on right there.
I liked his game. He's a
screw-up. Here, I'll give you Tim Riggins, like how Tim Riggins would actually wind up as a fullback in a Power 5 program. So he messes around, works for a couple years. He's not going to college. He just, you know, college ain't for me.
Yeah.
So he screws around.
He's going to work with his brother.
Works with his brother, bounces at a strip club for a little while. And then at a certain point, he decides, I got to get my stuff together, probably because he met a girl. And he's like, you know what? I can do better than this. And so he goes to community college for a year, gets his transcript in order, goes to wherever the girl is going to school, whatever large state university the girl is going to school at, and walks on because he's like, he sees some football players jogging by him. He's like, I could take them.
Texas Tech.
Walks on, and he is on the kickoff coverage team within like 4 hours of making the team.
And he's drafting the 6th round, and we have to hear about his story on draft night all night.
Correct.
What a great
story. Or you have to assign me a story that I have to write about that.
Yeah, exactly.
Last minute.
It wasn't last minute. It's doing like 3 weeks. You know how many other writers have to do these stories, Ari? All right, Andy, I want to ask you a question about facilities. You're at Florida mid-90s, and we always talk about facilities in college football and recruiting, but I think most people kind of forget, especially if you're younger, that boom did not happen until the late 90s, early 2000s.
Nobody even thought to ask about that.
They redid
our shower in the JV locker room my freshman year. And we were like, awesome. Now the tiles won't be so grimy. Like that's the only thing we were thinking. Nobody thought about what they have now.
Right. I heard Jerry DiNardo on an interview here in Nashville a couple years ago, or maybe it was like 10 years ago, was talking about facilities. And he's like, this is all new. He said, when I left for Vanderbilt to LSU, Vanderbilt, their facilities were the same. This was like in 93. He said it only happened about 5 to 10 years later. So
yeah, it's almost as if they got a bunch of money and had to spend it on something.
Exactly. So is Florida, have they caught up yet?
Well, we won't know until they open the facility in the summer. We'll see. But this feels like kind of the last step that they needed to take, because when I was covering that program in the mid-2000s, when Urban Meyer got there, he was appalled hadn't changed a whole lot since the mid-90s at that point. And he begged them to build kind of a front door, because you used to have to go, if you were going to the coach's office, you just went in this kind of nondescript side door on the side of the stadium and went up a back staircase, and then you were in the coach's offices. Like, they wanted something a little more grand than that to show recruits. So they built this kind of glass encased front door area and put the trophies in there. And so they had that, but that took a lot of teeth pulling. He basically had to wrangle the lead donor, who was Bill Heavener, who real estate guy who happened to be Bob Tebow's college roommate, which helped, you know, the introduction and everything. But that was sort of, they didn't get a lot of yeses on that stuff for a long time. Meanwhile, Tennessee is sort of like,
well, let me interrupt you. Was it because they were winning,
rebuilding it, tearing it down, rebuilding it? So
Andy, let me interrupt you. How much of that was because they were winning and people were like, why, we're winning national championship. Well, why do we need to do that?
It was Steve Spurrier when he was there would go into Jeremy Foley and make fun of the schools that had indoor facilities or that had fancy football operations buildings. Now, look, fancy rich schools. We don't need any of that. We're winning. And Jeremy believed him. Now, the thing is, Jeremy still believed him when Spurrier was gone. Spurrier, you know, is at South Carolina going, man, we need better facilities here. And he's then helping raise the money for South Carolina to build the facilities that they now have. Whereas Florida is still saying, well, we didn't need it when Steve Spurrier was here and winning X number of SEC titles. So why would you need it now? And what's interesting about it is, and this is I was thinking about this the other day, let's say this facility is beautiful, palatial, whatever, and everybody loves it, and it finally catches them up. Do facilities matter anymore? Is it all NIL?
Everybody already has them.
My
understanding is that a player would never go to a school because they've got good facilities. They might not want to if they have bad ones.
Correct. And look, having to walk across the street to the practice field is not that big of a deal, I don't think. It didn't hurt anybody back in the day. Plus, back then, the O'Connell Center had the inflatable roof.
Yeah.
So if they opened the doors, the wind would blast out of the air would blast out.
I was there in those times.
Oh, yeah. So like after practice, when it's a billion degrees, you could stand there as you're walking back to the stadium and be like, So you can't do that. You won't be able to do that anymore because the new facility will just dump right out onto the practice field. But they'll have the privacy they want. You won't be able to do things like I did when I was a beat writer, which was camp out in that parking garage and see who walked to practice and who didn't, or who was wearing a non-contact jersey and who wasn't. You know, you can close a practice, but you can't close a public road. So there was, a little less, mystery at that point.
Yeah, I just think that's interesting because a lot of, especially younger college football fans, probably don't realize what Urban Meyer did, recruiting wise with the facilities he had competing against who he did.
When I was at Ohio State with Urban, I will never forget this. One of the first years of his tenure, we were walking through the facility, just me and him.
Oh,
and he looked, it was just like amazing. No, I mean, we were just walking through the stadium, through the facilities, and he like looked at me and he goes, look at these trash cans. Look at these trash. How am I supposed to recruit to these trash cans? And then a month later,
beautiful
chrome trash cans.
With big O's probably on them, right?
With big Ohio State logos on them. And I was just like, damn. And I think that was like number one thing that, when people talk about coaches and their job searches, a lot of times people worry about the salaries or the location and the footprint. And all those things are true. But buy in from an administrator that will give you what you need financially to do what you need to do, I think is the most underrated thing when it comes to what we talk about a job. So like even as we're doing our job rankings, Andy, and I don't know if there's a way to quantify like a scale from 1 to 10 of each position of each program and what their administrative buy-in is. But if you do have a coach that can say, you know what, we need something new, or this isn't working for me, or this is going to hurt us, to have your boss say, you know what, we'll write you a check for whatever you want, just go win, I think is invaluable. And I think that might have been one of the main, and obviously he was from Ohio and stuff, but one of the main appeals of that job when he came out of
Ohio State, Oklahoma, Georgia. Now, Georgia wasn't like that before, is like that now. But Oklahoma, we think, is going to be like that going forward. That's actually kind of the $64 million question with Oklahoma. Texas has not been that way. Florida has not been that way. USC,
Texas A&M is that way
not
now.
Sure. Texas A&M is definitely that way now. Was not that way pre Kevin Sumlin. So that's the thing. I do wonder how much does that change with NIL? Like, how much do schools care about facilities relative to caring about NIL? Because I always explain to people that not the most recent one with Brady, but the first Super Bowl the Tampa Bay Buccaneers won with that Warren Sapp, John Lynch, Derek Brooks team, like they were working out of trailers. They didn't have a beautiful facility. Who cared? They signed free agents because they offered them the most money.
Yeah. I mean, we don't need to get into this, but Ari, in your mailbag this week, talked about how will NIL affect how we look at coaches as recruiters? Does it matter as much now to be an ace recruiter if it's all about your collective?
Yeah, I think it's annoying.
One could argue that we judged coaches as recruiters without taking that into account before.
Already?
Yeah.
With the bag? Yeah.
Yeah.
You okay? Ari's getting choked up because it's
recruiting the bags.
Yeah.
Now that the bag is legal.
At least we could have pretended back then.
Yeah, exactly.
We can't pretend anymore.
All right. Did you guys...
Actually, how good of a coach would Dan Mullen be if he ended up at Program X and they recruited a Georgia roster? The guy might be the best coach in college football right now.
Well, the question is, would his personality work with players who were getting, you know, significant amounts of money and had some more power? I don't know. I think that's part of the reason that he kind of burned out a little bit was, I don't know that he liked the idea of coaching in that environment. I think that matters too.
Because you got to coach the personalities of the type of kids that only go to a place for money.
Yeah. You're basically breaking down coaches and how good they are at college the same way you would with an NFL coach. It's the same thing.
What makes a good college coach and what makes a good NFL coach used to be radically different. My guess is those two things are going to converge.
All right. Did you guys read?
And then my job is going to cease to exist.
Yeah, it's okay. Ari. We'll find you something else.
Yeah, let's.
We'll make you a full-time podcast.
Andy, you'll take care of me. Arizona, yeah, exactly. You can cover Arizona. Move back to Tucson.
I can't wait to have a recruiting podcast breaking down trends, philosophy, and theory when in 3 years when all it is just an open bidding war on eBay.
Ari, NFL free agency podcasts do huge numbers.
Yeah.
Like, what's the difference?
No, I know.
There'll always be a spot for you, Ari.
I didn't want to be an NFL reporter.
All right.
But
third time here, Ari.
I guess I am now. Okay.
Did you read Ubbin's story today?
I read a few of the stories, but not all of them. Okay. But I was talking to Ubbin while he was putting together. But I have it bookmarked to read once I was done with my podcast. Yeah, but we're supposed to
read it before the podcast so we could talk
about
it.
Was that an assignment?
Yeah, it was in my notes, my Slack note to you that I said, let's...
I've literally never read your Slack note once in my entire life.
Wow.
I'm breaking up with you.
I didn't realize berating Ari was something you could
do this
with.
I have to hit back. You should have. Andy, today when he was editing my story, he sent me a message with a sentence that was in it. And he goes, what's wrong with this sentence? And I couldn't figure it out. And he goes, you don't know why I sent this to you? And I said, I can't figure out what you're trying to say.
That's a dad way to do it.
And it was like five different messages.
No, what's wrong with this picture here?
Yes, he did it to me. And I said, on the fifth time, I said, can you stop patronizing me and just tell me what I did? And then he pointed it out. And I was like, oh, that's obvious. But like, I wasn't seeing it.
It's tough love. Ari.
So I'm going to give you crap back, though, because it's the only way I can exist in this job.
That's fine. All right, so
okay, I think I'm familiar enough with Ubbin's story.
Stories, the one where the guy that I want to know the coach who blew up the family's toilet.
Well, yeah, I know that one.
I've also heard there's more to it than that. That there may have been a gas station or a drugstore bathroom also blown up on the same visit. The pit bull one was pretty good, where they basically put this giant pit bull next to the coach and to see how the coach will respond. And the dad at the end, you did fine, coach. You did fine.
The test. I would be. Ari and I have talked about.
My favorite one from the ones that I read was the one
horse.
Where the guy's hearing aid broke their television.
I like the
I
guy.
Still
the one.
Did you
read the horse?
How that,
the guy with a horse in front of Kentucky Fried Chicken. But yeah, I would be a terrible recruiter because I'm scared of dogs, and I couldn't be. I don't like being around dogs, and I can't eat anything. Andy, I've got celiac disease, so I can't have gluten.
Could you imagine going into every single person's home?
My wife has celiac, so I know exactly how.
Imagine going to some grandma and trying to explain to her I can't eat her fried chicken because I can't have gluten. She would look at me like I'm crazy and tell me to eat it.
Yeah, and what's funny is people who've never experienced it or don't know anybody who have, they're like, well, I couldn't not eat cake. I'd just eat cake and deal with the consequences. No, you would not.
No, you wouldn't. Because Britt has it too. And when she acts and like she has it where if she even has anything small on accident, her night's over. And I don't mean it in a gross way. I mean like physical pain in her stomach.
And it can go, the symptoms can go for, you know, up to a week depending on how much the exposure you got. So
I sometimes think that I would be a much healthier person if I had it.
You would be.
No.
Yeah,
no, I mean, okay, here's the thing. I appreciate all the bougie people going gluten-free thinking it's healthy because it has produced a lot, a wider array of options for my wife when we eat out.
True.
But as someone who has to cook with all the tapioca flour and the rice flour and all that, the calorie difference is negligible.
I know, but I'm saying you take every single fast food restaurant off the board.
True.
Yeah, I don't eat
every pizza place off the board.
Gluten-free pizza is not as good. I don't eat the desserts.
I know,
you
just eat crap that you're allowed to have. Like, you would just go eat a bunch of potato chips and stuff.
So, Andy, have you ever been to Dreamland? Andy, I know you. I assume you have.
Yeah, that's the place all the tourists go in Tuscaloosa when you should be going to Archibald.
The barbecue, right?
Yes. I've actually never been to Archibald. I've
only been to Dreamland, and I've never been to Archibald.
But driving through in college, we went to New Orleans for spring break, so we were driving through Tuscaloosa, and I was the only one who had been to Dreamland. We had eight guys.
Oh, well, this was when it was good.
Yes.
This is the original on Jug Factory Road. Yes. This is when Dreamland was still good. Yes.
So I think we had eight guys. One of my buddies borrowed his mom's van, and not like a minivan, one of the old old school vans. And I was the only one who had been to Dreamland. So we had eight people there, and I said, we'll take, and one of my buddies was sick and was on some medicine or something and was driving. So I said, we'll take eight racks of ribs and seven Bud Lights. And this old waiter looks at me, he goes, what's wrong? And I said, well, he's kind of sick. And he looks at me and goes, there ain't shit wrong with him, and brings him a Bud Light. So the guy brought eight. It was great. So,
and then because that was back when Dreamland, the menu consisted of, you could order a rack of ribs or a half rack of ribs, and they would give you slices of white bread with
white bread. Yes.
Yeah, I went there.
Okay.
I wanted to be included, but I've never been to Archibald's. So
yeah, I've heard other people talk about Archibald's. Is that new? Relatively new?
No, it's actually older.
It's just Dreamland was still great then.
Or I don't know if it's older, but they're both very old. Like Archibald's is basically some guy's house in Northport, and it's been around for a long time. And the line is out the door pretty much every day. And it's a family business. The other members of the family have opened other barbecue places in town under the name Archibald and Woodrow's. It's not quite the same, not as good. But the original Archibald's, the ribs are fantastic. The Dreamland, from what I understand, is when they got bought out, the quality, control was kind of lost, and they tried to franchise out to a bunch of places. So it used to be legendary. And now if you go because I've been, since all this, and it'll be like, if there's a crowd, they just crank up the heat and dry them out. And it's not very good. Archibald's, if they're going to cook them one way, and if it doesn't work, or if they're out, they'll be like, oh, we'll see. We'll reopen in 4 or 5 hours. Let you know. So.
Yeah, they're, this was probably 92, 93. So this was back in probably the heyday there. All right, let's hit the mailbag. Some questions. Andy, I pulled this one specifically for you. We talked about Florida a little bit earlier, but this is from Branson S. What is your opinion of the early progress made by Billy Napier and his army at Florida? Do you think he can make a measurable dent in the pervasive poaching that Kirby, Saban, and others have done on the talent in the Sunshine State?
So Florida has figured out the price of admission. Will it work? We don't know. That is a bigger question that requires, luck and some other stuff. But they figured out what the price of admission is to be competitive in the SEC now. And so when you look, and Napier gets there and he signs a safety who had been considering Georgia, like that's a big moment, because the Florida wasn't beating Georgia head to head for a lot of players. And now you're getting players who are coming to see Florida who are also coming, players who are considering Georgia and considering Alabama. And that's not who Florida was kind of in the mix for the previous two administrations. They every once in a while they would be, but now it's more of a regular occurrence. So they definitely have that part figured out. Staffing wise, they seem to understand what they need from a manpower standpoint. Whether it's going to work or not, again, another question, because Kirby's got it rolling at Georgia. And what Mario can do at Miami, if they are funding it the way they claim that they're funding it, there's a real good chance Mario is going to be able to lock down some of those South Florida players down there. So Billy's job got harder because Miami decided to play the game this way. But that doesn't mean you can't do it. There's still lots of good players in Florida. There's still players in Georgia and Alabama and Louisiana and Texas who will come to Florida. So if you can build that, you know, build up that reputation that you are going to be a place that that goes after the best and wants to have the best come play there, you got a chance. But you got to get them, and then you got to coach them who wins on the field, and we won't know until we see them play.
Andy, was there a single commitment during the Dan Mullen era that was as impressive as what they did with Kamari Wilson last year?
No, because they just didn't. I mean, Gervon Dexter, I guess, would be the biggest one in terms of
where's
who they
from?
Were up against. He's Wilson? Dexter's from Miami. Wilson. He's from Miami.
Yeah, okay. I thought he was a Florida guy. Sorry, what are your thoughts on? I mean, I know you've been pro Napier.
I mean, I've been pro Napier because he did something right out of the gate that Florida had seemingly lost the ability to do. And that was on the job for what?
A month? Dexter's from Lake Wales. I apologize. So,
and now if you like notice too, like in the return of this week in recruiting is back, by the way, guys.
Yeah. I don't know. Out today.
We're back to doing it weekly now that things are starting to ramp up, but Florida and all the recruits that I was writing about today and all the recruits that I seem to be like, you know, I peruse 247 profiles all day, every day. Florida is in the mix with everybody. And that was not the case 6 months ago.
Two of those five stars in Alabama that we talked about.
Yeah, and when you ask me, am I all in on Napier, I guess I don't know how to answer the question before I see the results. But in terms of the early returns, I mean, there's a clear night and day difference with what Florida is doing from just an involvement standpoint.
Yeah, there's not an active resistance to doing what you have to do to win in the SEC, which before it kind of felt like, oh, we, you know, the attitude in the program was you don't need to do that stuff. You can just out coach him. And that's why Kirby said what he said after the Florida Georgia game this year. Like, you can't out coach talent.
Dude,
that
Kirby
was a
the man fired.
He did. He really did. That was a direct shot. And it was also 100% true. So,
and how do you get six top 100 players? Because you're involved with 30 of them now.
Right. So Napier clearly understands the process of how that works. He's just got to make it work and complete the process. So that's what I'm interested to see. I went on Feinbaum last week and mentioned that they probably have the toughest opening duo of any team in the country. Like if you look at every schedule, there's some teams that have a tougher opener, but to go Utah, Kentucky right in a row, that's pretty rough. Now they get them both at home, but this may be a summer of managing expectations ahead of that.
But so, even though Kentucky's had success against Florida, those aren't two programs that jump out to a lot of Florida fans and are like,
what? I think Utah does only because Urban Meyer came from Utah. So a lot of people kind of pay attention to them. I'm not sure that the average fan understands like how good Utah was last year and what they're bringing back.
Right.
But I do. It'll be interesting because I think that's one where I would imagine Utah's probably favored.
Those are the worst games for coaches. It's like basketball playing a really good mid-major on the road, like where the coach knows that, you know, that's going to be a really good.
I mean, they were the Pac-12 champs last year. It's pretty.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's going to be interesting to see because if they can split those two, I think that bodes well for them. But this roster that they brought back is not what it needs to be, and they'll tell you that right now. They're also Napier. I've been impressed. They've not made a lot of excuses. And a lot of times you get a new coach in, and he's giving all these coded messages about what I inherited stinks.
And I was afraid he was at the beginning because he did start up with the stars don't matter crap on his first. And I just people were misunderstanding him, me included. But I was like, oh boy.
I think what he's saying is, what I inherited is what I inherited, but I will not make excuses for it. I've heard him say that multiple times. I have no excuses. I've heard him say multiple times. So they're working on the rest of it. That point forward, I think, you know, they're going to work to improve the roster, but they got to deal with what they inherited. So that part I am just fascinated by because what was left at the end of last season was not what you expect to see from a Florida roster. It just wasn't. So that they're going to have to coach their butts off to get a halfway decent result.
All right, two more questions. Ari, we have addressed this on the pod before, but I think sometimes we make the assumptions that we know how the media works and fans don't, or people are curious about stuff like this. So Logan T. asks, when a sports writer or recruiting service publishes a forecast or a crystal ball for a recruit weeks or months before the player has verbally committed, what information are they receiving to come to that conclusion, and from whom do they receive it?
One of the coaches going, we got him. I mean, a lot of times. Or a recruiting staff or that sort of thing.
Yeah. These coaches can't publicly on the record. They can't comment on the recruits, but yeah. You know, that's how information is shared.
I mean, these guys at work at 247 are the ones that are doing the crystal balls. And yeah. I know there are some people who don't work at 247 that also have access to doing them, right? These guys are talking to these kids and their families and assistant coaches and recruiting staffers 24 hours a day. And I think that it's easy to get a pulse of where you think somebody's going early if multiple people are telling you, hey, also, this is where it's treaded.
With the recruiting sites, their networks, which helps as well, because let's say school X has a staffer tell their person, hey, we got this guy. Well, school Y is also allegedly in the mix for this guy. So that guy, the guy who covers school X is going to call the guy who covers school Y and go, do they think they're out or do they think they still have a shot? And when the guy who covers school Y goes, yeah, they're out, they're not, then okay, crystal ball. Like that, they have some checks and balances there that help because the crystal ball thing, those guys don't take it lightly. Like they don't like to be wrong.
Well, they have egos about their percentages
The one thing I've never understood about the crystal ball thing is, and maybe there's an answer to this, I'll have to call Steve Weltfong, he'd tell me. But if you put in a crystal ball for somebody in July to program X, and then at the end of the road, he flips to program Y and you found out an hour before he did it and you crystal ball them there, do you still get a hit for that?
You can change your crystal ball. I don't know about
that. So if you change your crystal ball late in the process, like it's easier to get a higher hit ratio.
I don't know the mechanics of
that. Because like I think that the crystal ball isn't so much a tool to predict where the person is going to actually end up. I think it's a tool to give an indication in the recruiting profile to the fans and the people reading the profile of where that person is trending in the moment.
All right. Good answer. Logan T has another question. This one's fun. I haven't really thought about it too much, but I thought both you guys would enjoy it. If colleges could trade signed commits like the NFL can trade draft picks, what type of deals might we see done? For this hypothetical, let's say that the commits could only be traded after they signed, but they enroll. If I'm interpreting this correctly, could you sign two top 100 guys for a junior quarterback who started 5 games the previous year? I guess that's what he's getting at.
Like, would Oklahoma have traded Spencer Rattler for a bag of Fritos?
I don't think it would be a bag of Fritos. I think they could have traded him for...
No, they could get a lot.
Yeah, they could have traded him for something. And I think... I mean, isn't that kind of what is happening? Like the Browns are going to sit there and wait to see if somebody needs a quarterback and then try to trade Baker Mayfield and get something out of him, or Jimmy Garoppolo once he has his surgery, that the 49ers are going to see what the market is and then trade him.
So I think teams would sign more. Teams would be even more willing to sign multiple 5-stars in a class if you could trade them.
Well, then that would just be asset collecting, of course. Yeah. I mean, I think, what do you mean would be more willing to sign 5-star prospects? Everybody's willing to fight.
Well, no one signs two fives. Very few sign. I mean,
it's not because they're not willing. Who's not willing?
True.
Everyone's willing.
I mean, we talk about how some programs like Oklahoma didn't want to sign 5-stars in back-to-back years because they wanted to spread out.
Yeah. Well, I think the quarterback
is the only place where you might even have an issue there.
Like when you can't trade them, you don't want to sign 2 5-star quarterbacks every year. You don't want, I mean, I know guys would leave, but you don't want 8 scholarships tied up on quarterback.
No, you can't. I mean, you have some numbers you got to deal with. Like, yes, you will take all the 5-star defensive linemen who want to sign with you, all the 5-star offensive linemen, because you have multiple places to put them on the field.
Could you imagine signing a letter of intent with USC out of high school and then they shipped you off to Washington State?
It'd be crazy.
Well, I mean, sorry, that's what NFL people have to do.
That's the thing with the draft. Like, you know, everybody's like, well, why can't they ever get parity? The NFL has a draft. Like, you're never going to have a draft with the number one pick. UConn selects Malachi
Nelson. That'd be awesome.
Moving to stores, Dad. Yeah.
That's hilarious. That's a funny question.
Yeah, it's a good question. It was a good question.
People would be waiting till the beginning of the fall camps to make sure that they're not trading for somebody who's going to enter the portal anyway.
or trying to like, it'd be funny too if you could trade spots in on your roster, like scholarships. Like a team could trade for like 15 extra scholarship spots so that they have 100 scholarships and then team B only has 70. That'd be hilarious.
I would coaches in the hot seat would be just wheeling and dealing. They'd be trading 20 scholarships for two offensive linemen.
Yeah, I would. I'd be like, hey, yeah, my roster would be 30 scholarship spots of only five-star prospects.
Well, this brings in the very real possibility that like the head of your school's collective is going to become your school's de facto GM. And like if they ever get crossed with your school's coach and you have like a Trent Baalke, Jim Harbaugh situation, like who's going to win the power struggle?
Yeah, well, here, guys, this is another question in the mailbag that I almost answered, but I wanted to save for the podcast. And Mitch, I'm sorry for taking your job from you, but you might have already used this. But someone asked an interesting question, and I thought it was worth discussing. Will the collective world in the NIL world make it so that scholarship totals are irrelevant because they're handing out so much money in NIL that these kids will be willing to pay for their education if there's more than 85 scholarship worthy players?
There's a more important number than 85 as far as that goes. 20, and it's 22.
Yeah.
We know Matt Castle's name. We know his story because it's so rare. You still got to play to make it to the NFL. So you can stockpile a bunch of guys. And if you have a bunch of NIL money, you could have like 25 more de facto scholarship players. They're all going to leave because they're not playing.
Well, Andy, I wanted to ask you this when I did see that question, and I know for the most part, scholarship player and walk on players. And you were walk on your entire career,
such as it was.
Okay, so walk ons, like if you're not part of the program, you don't necessarily know the difference, right? Like you know, I traveled with Vanderbilt. I couldn't tell you who the walk on, like they ate the same meals.
It depends on the program. Some programs treat them very differently. Yeah. Some programs, like I explain this to people, like Steve Spurrier's program. When you were on the team, you were on the team. And it was a matter of could you play or could you not play? Like there was a guy named Alex Willis who was in the same walk-on class as me. I didn't even know he was a walk-on for the first like 2 weeks I was there. He was that good. Mm-hmm. And he wound up being a scholarship receiver and contributing.
But you ate all the same meals and everything?
Well, that was different back then. You couldn't be part of the same meal. You couldn't be part of the training table stuff and all that back then as a walk-on. Now you can.
That's my question. So, if you're afforded all the same luxuries as a scholarship player,
yeah, you have it really, money, it really comes down to how you play. Yeah.
What did you eat?
I had a meal plan.
Just like a normal student, right?
The dining hall had just opened. So the first couple weeks when they were bringing random muckety mucks through the dining hall, the food was fantastic. And then it got real bad real fast.
The thing I don't understand, though, is if you don't eat with the training table, because these guys eat in the buildings now. So I guess a lot of changes.
This was very different than Ari. Like the football, like most of their meals, the scholarship players were in the same dining hall as me. Same food.
Okay. So you still get to eat with your friends.
Yeah. So it wasn't, it wasn't like that. There was,
I always just like felt bad for people who don't get to eat with the team. I'd be like, well, what are you going to do? Just go eat by yourself?
Yeah,
like Steven Blansburg?
But that was then like, there was a middle period there where a walk-on would have not been able to eat like training table meals. And now they can.
Yeah.
All right. Ready for a little trivia.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Andy, how many top 100 or name the top 10 players of Florida's have signed in the history of their program?
If
Powell,
if the 247 composite existed in the mid 90s, what would Andy Staples' national rank be? That's not my question.
Zero.
Okay. But national rank, like 1200?
Would not be ranked at all. Okay. I would have been like a two star or no star.
Okay. Real quick here, trivia. How many teams that had multiple five stars on their roster last season had a losing record?
Ooh.
And I went multiple five stars because you have the random bounce backs.
Okay.
You know,
okay. That was just
in the transfer portal, too.
On their roster, like not a signee. Like, so, like, one team, it wasn't Charlotte, but someone like Charlotte had a five star.
But, like at Florida, Justin Shorter still counts as a five star.
Yes.
Even though he signed as a five star with Penn State.
Wow. Okay. How long did it take you to look that up, man?
No, I mean, I just went to the talent composite, and I know off the top of my head which team. I know someone went 9-3. I mean, I had to look.
Right.
A few teams went 6-7 or 7-6. It didn't take me long.
Okay. Well,
because I don't even know how many.
We know that.
I don't even know
Texas
how many.
Texas and Florida, we know they finished below 500.
Two. A bunch of teams went 6-7, so don't think bowl games. Like, there's a lot of Power 5 teams that lost.
So was game. It? You said at least 2 5-stars.
Yes.
Washington might be one, right?
That is correct.
12. Was it 12 total?
Eight.
Okay.
Eight.
Okay. LSU.
So we made 3 of them.
LSU, Florida, mm-hmm. USC, Texas, Auburn, Washington, North Carolina, and TCU. And Ari, this is not good for your brand. 4 of Maryland. The top 11 teams in the team talent composite had losing records last year.
Did you just name out all of them?
Eight.
LSU, Florida, USC, Texas, Auburn, Washington, North Carolina, and TCU.
TCU had multiple 5-star. Zach Evans was on their team last year.
Yes. That's the. These that's teams.
Are you giving us the answer? Yes, I don't understand what you're doing.
I told you the answer.
why are you telling us the answer?
Yeah, Andy. I know Andy has to go soon, so we had, we're trying to cut things short here.
I was actually going to try to get this right. You didn't say Maryland. I know Maryland had 2 5-stars.
They went 7-6.
Did they have a winning? They did?
Yeah, so there's a lot of that, that 7-6 is a winning record, 6-7.
Hey, excuse me.
Dakari and Joyner making sure that that North Carolina had a below 500 record. Although I guess South Carolina
went 7-6.
Right, so if that result had changed, I think South Carolina probably
had. Was he a 5-star? I thought he was a high 4.
I think he was a 4-star.
Yeah, but South Carolina on the D-line, they had 2, but they were 7-6. So.
Yeah, so whoever had won that game, the other one was going to be on this list.
Yeah.
So,
Ari?
All right, Andy. I appreciate you stopping by and being our first 2-time guest. Hey, you are you're a 2-time guest with a winning record. I appreciate you. And
2-time winner, I'll take it.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll probably talk to you later today.
all right, I'll see you guys.
Mitch, thanks so much for being an awesome host. I thought that was an interesting show.
Yeah, good show.
And
good
to
times.
All of you guys who have continued to support Stars Matter throughout the years, or the weeks, or the months, however long it's been, we really appreciate you, and we'll catch you guys next week.